The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they're easy, but because they are hard.
Start by 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to our Sunday Space Show program. I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in today. A couple of quick announcements. We're on the 90-minute format today, so if you do want to get a question or a phone call in to our guest, Barry, who I will reintroduce in just a minute, please watch the clock and still get it in while we're still on the air. The phone number is 866-687-7223, which I'll repeat often during the show, and email drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. The website newsletter for next week is already made, and as you see, we have a full week. And Hotel Mars has been confirmed with Dr. Jeff Faust, who is going to continue discussing COVID-19 and the effect on space conferences, the space industry, and some scheduled launches coming up. Already more event cancellations have taken place over and above the program that John Batchelor and I did last Wednesday. So Jeff Faust will be with us this Wednesday to update us on that. And the rest of the week is as planned. We have a Tuesday night program, Friday morning program, and Sunday open line. And then on a very sad note, the Space Show lost one of its great friends, a great personal friend of mine, and a great guest, Dr. Jeff Bell. He did 22 Space Show programs. And all programs for the month of May, for the month of March, are dedicated in Jeff's memory. I posted a note about it late last night on the website, so you can read a little bit about it. And as I said, if Jeff finds some kind of way to call in on his cosmic voyage, I will take the call and interrupt our programming, and we'll let Jeff have his say. I'm not expecting that phone call, but, you know, it's a crazy world out there. Who knows what may happen. And for today, I am very, very happy to bring back to the program Barry DeGregorio. And if you recall, he was on with Gil Levin several weeks ago. And at the end of that show, he kind of teased us a little bit and prompted us about his upcoming book. His upcoming book has come out on the market. You can find it on Amazon. It is titled Discovery on Vera, V-E-R-A, Rubin, R-U-B-I-N, Ridge, Trace Fossils on Mars. We're going to be talking about that today with Barry. You take a look at the cover photo. You'll see that on Amazon. And Barry really needs no introduction on the Space Show because he has been a guest on his own and with Gil multiple times. His full bio is on the program, but he is an honorary research fellow with Buckingham Center for Astrobiology, and his scientific interests include the study of geology, geomicrobiology, and the history of the Great Lakes region of the U.S. and Canada. He also studies ichnology, a science which combines the study of dissolution cavities left behind by organisms along with their tracks, trails, and burrows. He's a published author. He has worked with Gil Levin on some of the work with his labeled release experiment. And we're very, very happy to have Barry with us. But before I let Barry start talking, remember our toll-free number is 866-687-7223. And you can email us at drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. The website newsletter is already posted. You will see it over on the upper right of our homepage. Everything we do is archived. Don't forget to check out our Space Show store. What you need to do is just click on any of the photos of Pepper listening to the Space Show, and she will guide you to our terrific Space Show store for logo wear. And then don't forget also, listening instructions are up in the upper left menu under Listen Live, listening and podcast instructions. If you have any questions, email me. And then remember, we're a nonprofit 501c3 with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. We're listener-supported, meaning you, the listener, with your financial contributions, keep the Space Show on the air. So if you like our programming, our guests, our interactions, help us out, support us. Remember, as a nonprofit, you do get a tax deduction for your gift. That might be on your mind, given that April 15th is just around the corner. And if you're a California taxpayer, you also get a tax deduction. We're a public benefit corporation in the Golden State, or maybe the once Golden State, depending on your perspective. And there's a huge PayPal button at the top of the Space Show page. That's the easiest way to donate to us. If you would prefer doing it the old-fashioned way, make checks payable to One Giant Leap Foundation. Mail them to Box 95, Tiburon, California, 94920. If you have any questions about any of this, don't hesitate to email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Don't forget we have sponsorships, so sponsors get their banner ads running across our homepage. They can change their banner as often as they want. During the break between first and second segments, I will shout out and read our sponsor messages, because on the full-length programs, the sponsors get their 60-second message read, and on the shorter programs, we just tell everybody who our great sponsors are: Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, Astrox, AIAA, Moonwords, Celestis, the National Space Society, the Space Plan, and I guess, you know, that's it. And we'll shout out to them with their messages again when we break for first and second segments. Barry, welcome back to the Space Show. How are you? And it's good to have you back on the program.
I'm good, David. Thank you for having me on.
Always a pleasure. Introduce us to discovery on Vera Rubin Ridge trace fossils on Mars.
Okay. I'm going to approach this from maybe one or two different angles. When I was doing research on Curiosity images in December of 2017, it was during the time period that the science team was taking a break, and the rover was, in effect, taking images using an autonomous software system named Aegis, and it came into a small crater on Vera Rubin Ridge, which is an escarpment of sorts, as it was about to begin its ascent up Mount Sharp, the mountain that is in the middle of Gale Crater. And as it rolled into this one crater, just unnamed crater, it was a 20-meter crater, maybe in diameter, and it was just simply designated as Site 67. And I began looking at the images that were coming in the day that they happened to be on the Curiosity website, and I noticed a lot of little, like, objects dotting the mudstone, which Curiosity had been examining for the last maybe 100 or so sols. And these objects were dark, and they were, the same size. Some of these were the same size. I call these beans in the book. And, you know, I didn't really concentrate on the beans so much, but when I saw them and I saw that they were just about the same size, these were dark, just like you would see like a kidney bean on the surface of a few rocks as it entered this crater at Site 67. As the days went on, the rover moved into a different position or two and came across the rock Harold Swick, which is a rock with some nearby similar fragments that were laying on top of the soil, basically. And it just looked so unique. I mean, these things have never been seen on Mars before. And when I finally got a better look at them, I mean, I was trying to enlarge them. And we're talking Sol 1903 here and up to Sol 1905, looking at every image I could enlarge to get a better image of idea what these were. And the rover, before, you know, it took any real high-resolution images with the MOLLE microscopic imager on Curiosity, it was rolled away. And I'm thinking to myself, well, you know, they just left these mast cam images, lower-resolution mast cam images, and went off. I mean, these objects had never been seen on Mars before. But by about Sol 1912, I believe, by 1912, they rolled back Curiosity. And for those that don't know it, they hardly ever do this, do a rollback, you know, unless the features that they were looking at, you know, are important, intriguing, you know, we got to go back and look. So when this happened, they started getting higher resolution images, and looking at them, I just immediately recognized their patterns as slightly flattened burrow structures that I've seen many hundreds of times while making studies along Lake Ontario. You know, these are trace fossils. Basically, you have ancient metazoan creatures like worms making their way through muddy environments and sediments, and they leave their trails or their burrows behind. And they're very easy to identify with the naked eye. And, you know, they're found all the time, you know, in sediments like lakes, rivers, and, of course, continental margins. So, you know, I'm thinking to myself, you know, what's going on here, you know? I was looking for information, and the only information I could get from NASA was that they thought, well, first of all, they were calling them sticks, you know, and I thought that was not a very scientific name for these objects. And, they told me that they thought they were salts or crystals from an evaporating lake. And so I wrote to one of the science team members who made that comment, and I asked if he would please send me some terrestrial examples of what he was talking about, because I've seen all kinds of crystals and so like calcium sulfide veins and you name veins and rocks, and this just wasn't it. These were three-dimensional.
Did he respond to you?
He did not. No, he did not.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah. You know, honestly speaking, though, many of the science team members are approachable and are honest with you to the best of their ability. But in this case, I got really suspicious. First of all, the rover is rolled back to look at these things again. So somebody, you know, as I said initially, you know, the rover was in this area during, you know, basically Christmas or holiday season. And the science team wanted time off, and so they basically took time off while the rover was still taking images, you know, probably with the autonomous software system that it has. It's designed to pick out rocks and bedrock of a unique nature, and it really found something unique this time, because none of these sticks, as NASA likes to call them, were ever seen before on Mars. So they truly were tiny, though, but that doesn't matter, because on Earth, you know, early metazoan life back during the Ediacaran period, like 600 to 550 million years ago, they were tiny, and they left very similar burrows and trails in the mud. And so I started to investigate further, because the sticks comment really threw me off, and I thought, you know, this is not science talking here. Sticks, you know, the more I looked at them, I thought, well, until they start taking some higher resolution images with the microscope imager on board Curiosity, we'll probably not know. And of course, I was hoping that the ChemCam, LIBS laser instrument, which fires laser pulses into the rock, could obtain, you know, the spectrum of the host rock and also the dark, shiny. They looked metallic. You can see them going on the website, and you can see that they're metallic in appearance. And you got to wonder, you know, why is there such a difference between these objects on the outside of the host rock and coming up with an explanation such as stick. So I wanted to find out, you know, if they were going to take some spectra, you know, with ChemCam and use the APXS, you know, instruments. And they fully intended to do that. You know, they put out on there's a website out there called the Analyst's Notebook, where, you know, all the scientific notes and planning of a viewing session with Curiosity would be placed. Unfortunately, that information would have to wait for 3 months before anybody in the public could see it. So I decided to write to the members of the science team that I knew, and I had a fairly good working agreement with Roger Weens, who was the principal investigator for the ChemCam instrument. So I just wrote to Roger and I said, you got some interesting objects here. Are you going to take some spectra of the host rock and then release the spectra of the dark sticks, which I'm calling burrows at this point. I said, these look like trace fossil burrows. And so that's how it began. You know, it just began as an investigation.
What did he say back to you?
That they had fully planned to do so. And, of course, you know, as time went on, we got to the point where the rover was getting ready to leave the site. And so they decided on Sol 1922. Okay. Now you got to picture this, where a Sol on Mars is a day.
Basically. Right.
And so here we are. We initially found these objects on Sol 1903 and 1905. The rover left the area, just on outside of the crater rim. And then, when they returned from their holiday, they came back and they started doing a more extensive imaging routine with the MASTCAM camera. And the Mascam itself started getting some really nice images of these things. So I guess it was time for the Molly camera to get right up there and take some imaging. And that those images, there was between Sol 1922 and 1923, there were something like 84 high-resolution images sent back to Earth and posted on the MSL, Mars Science Laboratory website. And anybody can look at these. Anybody can download them. And some of the detail in these is incredible. So at this point, I mentioned to a couple of local writers that I thought they looked remarkably like trace fossil burrows that I had studied, you know, around the Lake Ontario region, you know, from the Ordovician period. And that really got a lot of publicity. I guess I've counted maybe 300 or more newspapers and magazines that took that story. And boy, did I get a lot of publicity for that. So it was at that point ordained for me to do a scientific investigation to see if these were trace fossils. NASA, up to this point, you know, if you know the history of me with Gil Levin and my writing the book Mars, the Living Planet, and his experiences with NASA trying to get them to recognize his data as something real for the, you know, discovery of living microorganisms in the soil, you know, NASA at that point, you know, basically data in hand, you know, dismissed it for non-scientific terms. They said that because they couldn't find organic molecules on the surface of Mars, that Gill's experiment really didn't find life. He found some kind of chemical that mimicked life. So, I mean, you're going to have to go back and read that book. It's just too much information. But basically, I came out to defend Gil Levin's data in a book, you know, saying, well, they're dismissing the best evidence of life that probably they're going to have in a long time. And has it ever been a long time? Because for 40 years, over 40 years, NASA has never gone back with another life detection experiment or even to put a capable biological microscope on another mission.
Maybe they were warned away, like they used to say in the conspiracies.
Yeah. Well, you know, they always like to say conspiracy this, conspiracy that. But when is a conspiracy really a conspiracy?
Who knows? I can't tell you that.
I guess it depends on how good a lawyer you got.
I have an email question for you, the first one of the day,
sure.
Okay? So this is from Larry in Boston, and he said, I haven't read your book yet, but I have looked at it, and I've looked at the picture on the cover, and I've seen the reviews and the information posted on the blog. I have no clue, of course, that there are fossils on Mars or not, but I remember years ago, and I just searched David's website, he used to give airtime to this guy, Sir Charles Schultz, who claims there were fossils all over Mars, had photographic evidence, and he did multiple, maybe two or three, space show programs for David, claiming that he was a sir and titled as such from UK royalty. I forget much of the detail. If fossils were picked up so long ago, I think this was maybe 15 years ago where Schultz was on David's program, is it strange that you're picking up something now, or was Schultz ever told that he was in Lululand?
You know, actually, Schultz contacted me to write, he asked me to write a foreword to his Fossils on Mars CD that he released with images. It was like a book on CD.
Yeah, I got that book someplace. He sent it to me.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it was years ago.
Yeah, so, you know.
Is he the real McCoy?
Well, he works in the movie industry. He works on, like, the Marvel movies, like, you know.
Well, I know that. So he could Photoshop fossils on Mars and convince 99% of the people.
Well, I don't think he did that. I think that he was, you know, generally convinced that what he was looking at was the real thing. And, you know, I prefer not to comment on his work because he's such a nice guy. And, you know, some of his stuff might be, you know, legit, you know.
He's still around?
Yeah, he works in the movie business.
And he really is a sir, right?
Well, he says he is by sir by a baron, a baron.
A baron, yeah. The queen didn't bestow it on him. He had somebody else bestowed the title to him.
Yeah, but the show here isn't about him.
Charles, and, but somebody brought up his fossil work listening to old space show programs.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, the big difference here.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. How did you distinguish what you're talking about versus what Sir Charles did?
Yeah, okay. It's called ground truth. Yeah, Charles really didn't. I mean, his images, which some of them are intriguing, of course, didn't have like the backing of radiometric dating. Okay, which was done with Curiosity and Gale Crater to find out exactly, well, close to when it was formed. And that's like 3.86 billion years to 4.56 billion years old. Okay, so they were able to, get some dating by analyzing the isotope of potassium as it slowly changes into argon. And this is the first time that it has ever been done on another planet. And they got very accurate dating to within 100 million years, they said. It was published in Science. So one piece of the puzzle was that here you have this area, Gale Crater, that could be dated. They dated a mud rock. And the mud rock, of course, is what was at the bottom of the lake that they found that was there. They found evidence for a freshwater lake that was neutral in pH, and it had a lot of the same elements that are needed, you know, for life on Earth.
Uh-huh.
So we're saying, you know, that you have a freshwater lake that I think the lead scientist at the time said would be drinkable by humans. So we have a situation, lake, mud, date, you know, this date for the habitability of Gale Crater Lake was like 3.7 billion years ago. Okay, so that we have from Curiosity. This is fantastic data we're talking about. So the next situation is, you know, the search for microbial, signatures in the mud or in the rocks. And Curiosity had been drilling into the rocks since it landed. And one thing it discovered right away was Mars has a lot of organic material, both in the rocks, soil, and, of course, methane was being emitted somewhere in Gale Crater that had a seasonal variability to it. So here you have a set of data showing that this lake on Mars, which was fed by a river system and probably by oceans that existed on Mars at that time when it had an atmosphere, a thicker atmosphere, this was the time that Mars flourished in the habitable zone. And to cap that, you know, I went through some of my older papers, and this is what really drew me to this. It was a paper by Christopher McKay, and he wrote it. Let's see, the name of the paper was Oxygen and the Rapid Evolution of Life on Mars. And he wrote a couple papers regarding how Mars could have, during its brief biotic history, estimated to be a billion years or less, that it experienced a range of biological evolution that would have been duplicated on the Earth. Only with the start of at the Cambrian. So what he was saying here was it was possible that metazoans, because we know that metazoans existed during the Cambrian, he said 3.7 billion years ago, at the time that Mars was in this relatively calm state of having a thicker atmosphere and water available in the atmosphere and oceans, probably rivers, lakes, that it could have experienced a faster evolution that could have risen to allow at least the kind of life that you would find on Earth up to the Cambrian. So that's trace fossils, you know. The first trace fossils that we recognize were these early worms that could maneuver across microbial mats. Microbial mats are important because they would have been a food source for early mobile metazoans. So if you're following me so far...
Yeah, and you have a phone call waiting, by the way.
Okay. Well, I'll just say that Chris McKay's paper really opened up the idea that Mars could have had metazoan life before the Earth did, because 3.7 billion years ago on Earth is when the first microfossils are found. So this, if this was true, that... metazoan life existed on Mars at the same time that life on Earth was at the microbiology stage. I mean, this would be huge. So I'll take that call now.
Oh, okay, hang on. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you? And thank you for calling.
This is Marshall. And, gee, you are talking right where I was thinking about asking a question. And basically, you're saying that the Earth and Mars developed life basically at the same time.
No, I'm saying that the evidence from Curiosity, if my hypothesis, now keep in mind, this is a hypothesis at this point. You know, I provide lots of images in my book of trace fossils and compare them to the Mars structures, which NASA calls sticks. But the difference being is that 3.7 billion years ago on Mars, we're talking about multicellular life, was there to leave the trace fossil. Okay, mm-hmm. Basically to they call it bioturbation when these organisms live in a watery environment or near the water sediment surface, and they seek out food in terms of organic material, and they leave these trails, tracks, and burrows that are unmistakable. And mm-hmm. at that time, on Earth, the oldest life at that time was microbial. They find it in the cherts in Australia, basically. Mm-hmm. We're talking about the Burgess Shale. So
yep.
Here you have a situation where if this is true, that 3.7 billion mark for Mars and the Earth shows that there was a great difference in the rapid evolution of life on Mars. And that was what Christopher McKay was starting to get at in his two, they were hypothesis papers, but they were interesting because, you know, he wrote them at, when is this one written? He actually wrote Oxygen and the Rapid Evolution of Life on Mars in 1995. So I always had that paper in the back of my head. And so, you know, I started looking at the Curiosity features on Harold Swick, and I began to enlarge them and use different techniques to rotate them, you know, using photogrammetric methods. Excuse me, I got to get a drink here. It's really dry in this room.
Well, also the topic's rather dry and the words start getting hard to say.
Yeah, that's it. Okay,
Barry, how do you verify that they're fossils?
How do I verify that?
Well, not you, but how does anyone, how does the industry, how does science verify that there are fossils on Mars? What's the verification? Do you have to be there in person and look at them or what?
No, basically, you know, the fossils themselves, now, they're not fossils of organisms. Now, this is the thing. These are trails, tracks, and burrows that these things leave as they're moving through the sediment. Because these organisms at the time were mainly soft-bodied organisms, you know, you never find their bodies. Basically, ichnologists who study trace fossils do not expect to ever find the body of the creature that made the burrow or the track or the trail.
Okay.
Okay, so, but it has, you know, it has become a very intricate science, and you don't need much to really look at other than measuring. You measure the width of the burrow to see if other burrows on the rock are the same dimension, which they are, and you look for tubular features, you know, which you would find, and you don't really find cylindrical tubular features in salts or crystals, okay? Not that are metallic in origin. Okay, and the story gets even more bizarre when you find out that when the Curiosity APXS instrument, which is designed to get, mineralogy information, they placed the contact plate right on the rock, on the Harold Swick rock, and they broke off a couple of features, you know, which got trapped inside the rock, you know, on the outer surfaces of some of the bumps on the rock. And another feature, which is probably the most surprising thing of all, was the longest feature, which was about 10 millimeters, about half of that got broken off by the contact sensor plate on the APXS instrument, and it rolled down onto the Harold Swick rock. And right there, you know, in the book, you know, I show these incredible enlargements, which anybody can really do if you go to the Mars Science Landing website, and you go to Sol 1922 and 1923 and start downloading the clearest images you can find on your computer, and then start enlarging them, and you will begin to see entire series of cylindrical objects going, like, into the mud rock, portions of it coming out of the mud rock, and nobody really mentioned anything about it except that they were like subangular and looked like crystals or sticks. And it looks like a classic classic evidence of bioturbation on the Earth. In other words, a block of rock that was filled with living organisms moving through it when it was moist and wet. And, you know, here you have NASA giving it a, you know, an explanation of it being salts or crystals, you know, and I just, you know, I couldn't understand that, and it seemed like they were, you know, ignoring evidence to me.
Marshall, do you have any more for Barry?
I was kind of leading into a question from previous space shows, and that is, does this imply that the Earth and Mars have something of a very similar biospace? In other words, what we kind of find on Earth, do we kind of expect maybe to find evidence on Mars that, you know, like viruses and, well, plankton and so on like that will eventually develop, started developing on Mars just like it did on Earth? And, you know, it's basically the same kind of chemistry in both places.
Yeah, I think there's the law of physics can be extended to both planets equally. But the point in my hypothesis is that Mars was in the habitable zone. It had evolution of metazoans, you know, multicellular life, 3 billion years before the Earth did. So what does that tell you? That tells you a lot. But then, of course, shortly after that period of 3.7 billion years ago, we approached the point where Mars was, you know, something happened to Mars, probably a large asteroid impact, along with Mars losing its internal capacity to create a magnetic field because it's a smaller planet. You know, eventually you had the atmosphere dissipate to space. Mm-hmm. You had the oceans, rivers, and lakes start to evaporate. And the Martian landscape became basically barren except for microbial life, which Gil Levin and Pat Stratt, you know, both scientists, biologists who worked on the Viking program in 76, say to this day that their data is good. They found microorganisms in the topsoil of Mars, you know, covered up by, I guess the Viking sample arm went into the soil like 3 or 4 centimeters, up to 6 centimeters, and got soil samples. They tested it under a variety of conditions, and it was, to them, the same kind of response that they saw in Earth tests before they sent their experiment to Mars. So the only thing that held that back by NASA refused to consider that it was life because the gas chromatograph mass spectrometer on Viking could not detect organic molecules to the parts per billion level.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, it sounds like we have plenty of room for more space cadets to make better tests to eventually get to Mars.
Yeah, and you know, with this coronavirus situation going on now, I think it's time to take a pause here and think about, you know, do you really want to bring samples of Mars directly back to the Earth without first knowing if it could cause any harm? And I do talk about that a little bit in the book. At the end of the book, I close it out, you know, and I close it out with Carl Wooshy, who was the microbiologist who discovered the archaea. It was the third domain of life on Earth, and it's usually the domain of life that everybody calls an extremophile today. And he used phylogenetic taxonomy of 16S ribosomal RNA. And his theory here, it's not a theory, it's fact. It revolutionized microbiology. But anyways, I asked Rushi, if he wanted to be a part of the organization I was putting together to warn, the public at large about bringing samples back from Mars, and that's called the International Committee Against Mars Sample Return. And he turned down the opportunity to be a scientific advisor, but he did make this comment to me, and I'll read it to you. He said, in May 28th, 1999, I consider it a very adventuristic assumption that Earth is safe from contamination from Martian organisms. Obviously, we know too little about life on Mars to make such assumptions. These are hand-waving arguments whose only purpose is to rationalize the technological feats these people at NASA wish to accomplish. It would appear from your description, mine, of the argument that those making the case for sample return have not even considered organisms that would change the global organismal balance once they took hold. And what that would lead to is totally unpredictable. Indeed, I get the feeling that those making the argument for sample return equate the lack of knowledge that it is unsafe with lack of danger. The whole argument brings to mind the attitudes that Feynman wrote about in his book. Try it, and if it doesn't work, then fix it. In this case, you couldn't fix it if it didn't work. So,
okay, I'm going to stop us here and take our break, and this is a good point to come back because we're more than midway through the program.
Okay.
Marshall, if you have something else, now is your time to get it off your chest or call back.
No, I'll hang up and listen.
Thank you. Listeners, we are going on break, but Barry is still connected with us, and we'll sit by. If you want to give us a call, 1-866-687-7223. And we do want to thank our sponsors. Without them, we would not be doing the show. Northrop Grumman is a leading global security company providing innovative systems, products, and solutions for government and commercial customers. And they have capabilities from undersea to outer space and cyberspace. Now, here's an interesting sponsor, and I've been talking about the Space Foundation's 36th Symposium. It was, notice past tense, set for March 30th through April 2nd in Colorado Springs. And you can get info at spacesymposium.org. It has been canceled, delayed, however you want to describe it, to maybe later in the year. Mostly they claim it was postponed or canceled because of the travel ban, and a big part of their conference are coming in from Europe, and a lot of the exhibit hall people are coming in from Europe. So it doesn't appear that that's going to happen this year, or if it does happen this year, it'll happen later. I will certainly keep everybody abreast of that. Astrox is a sponsor for us, and they have been involved in hypersonic space plane and reusable rocket designs for the Air Force, DARPA, and NASA for 3 decades. Their codes, HiSight and SpaceSight, create and analyze such designs. Visit Astrox, ASTROX.com. for a lot more information. In addition, AIAA sponsors us. Many of their events are on hold as well. The American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. It is the world's largest aerospace professional society. Lots of major events, 5, I think, during the year, but they have breakfast meetings, regional lunches and dinners. Networking to die for, and they have an incredible peer review library. You can get all the information about them at AIAA.org. Also sponsoring us is Celestis, and they are still the global provider of Memorial Spaceflight Services. They have a robust manifest coming up with Earth missions, suborbital missions, and their second lunar mission. You can put your DNA in with a little bit of the ashes of your loved one, and make the journey symbolically with your loved one. Check it out, Celestis.com. National Space Society is a sponsor. ISDC is still on the books for the end of May in Frisco, Texas. That's part of Dallas. Check it out at isdc2020.nss.org. MoonWords sponsors us, and we're always happy to talk to you about MoonWords if I can find my little message. What if a group of nations was determined to build a town on the moon and they based their decisions on technical and economic merit? MoonWords is building a digital vision of that town where you will be able to learn, play, build, and go to events. Visit MoonWords.com, download an early draft demo of the town, and help fund its development by subscribing. Help us help the world see a bigger future where we leave our past behind us. And then the Integrated Space Plan sponsors us, the highly developed development chart showing the path to becoming a spacefaring race. You can see how technologies and destinations build upon one another. You can get your own version of the space plan at thespaceplan.com. It's inspiring. You can frame it. Check it out. I have one hanging on the door to my little studio office. And welcome back, Barry. And we have a caller on hold waiting to talk to you. Are you ready?
Sure.
Hi, caller. Welcome to part two of our space shuttle program. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, David. This is John in Fremont, California.
Hi. Welcome back to the program.
Again.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Hi, Barry. So this is an interesting topic. So if your hypothesis is correct, then life evolved on Mars before it did on Earth is what it sounds like.
Well, yes.
At
the same time, John, you know, the difference being that life on Earth at 3.7 billion years ago was microbial in context, whereas on Mars it would be metazoan life, multicellular.
Right, right. So, but microbial life evolved on Mars too, first.
Sure, sure.
Right? Or,
yes.
Or maybe at the same time. What I'm getting at, and this, I think, has been hypothesized by others, is that, you know, there's exchange of material between Mars and Earth, where some people believe microbial life could survive, you know, in meteorites.
Yes.
From Mars.
Panspermia.
And is it possible that, you know, life evolved on Mars first and then seeded Earth?
Yeah, of course. I do feel that's possible. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's a pretty exciting idea. So the other thing I wanted to ask you is, you know, Zubrin's contention that because we have this exchange of material, that any microbial life that's on Mars is probably here on Earth. And so, you know, we haven't had any sort of mass extinctions or, you know, anything caused by a Mars virus. So, or that we know of. Maybe the coronavirus came from Mars. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things I did besides Mars research was I was a writer for Microbe Magazine. It was a magazine published by the American Society for Microbiology. And I had the extraordinary opportunity to talk to Dr. Cheryl Nickerson, who was conducting research on microorganisms flown on the both the space shuttle and the space station, International Space Station. And one of the things I got out of my interview with her was that as soon as you go up into space, the natural flora and bacteria that human beings carry with them start to mutate in a radiation environment. And of course, you know, the Earth itself is surrounded by this geomagnetic field, which sort of protects us. So there's still radiation coming in. but it's of a low-grade type of radiation that possibly over time, you know, in deep space could alter and mutate microorganisms to a level that we don't understand. So we know that the Mars environment has a lot more radiation, not only from the solar wind, but also from cosmic, the galaxy, you know. So who knows what microorganisms would mutate to at that point. So Mars and the Earth today are two different planets, really. I wouldn't expect any microorganisms there to be similar to what they are here on this planet because of the radiation environment. Carl Wooshy continued in the conversation that I had with him. He made some interesting comments. He said that all that is needed by Martian microorganisms, if they exist, is that it finds Earth life to be a good source of food and has the capacity to harvest it. All higher life on this planet has evolved in the context of the microbial life that exists here. It has evolved to cope with the latter's constant incursions. There are no guarantees. Indeed, I consider it unlikely that animals and plants could withstand the attacks of an alien microbial life, very different from terrestrial microbes, which it has not evolved. And I don't mean short-term adaptive evolution here. I mean the type of evolution that brought animals, for example, into existence in the first place. In military terms, you may have defenses against all the weapons the Russians or Chinese have, but you can't defend against weapons designed on another planet or solar system. H.G. Wells' book, War of the Worlds, had a favorable outcome, but Wells' invaders were not microorganisms.
How do you spell Carl Lucci's name?
Dr. Wooshy. Okay, well, I take it you know how to spell the first part.
Well, it's C-A-R or K-A-R-L, right?
Oh, yeah, well, it's C.
Okay.
C-A-R-L, and his last name is W-O-E-S-E.
W-O-E-S-T?
E.
W-O-E-S-E. W-O-E-S-E.
Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to be able to put him in the reference when I summarize the show.
Yeah, good idea. So, go ahead, Blair.
Continuing with that argument, if we've been exchanging Mars material all the time, wouldn't the evolution of life here incorporate that into their evolution?
Well, depending on the radiation environment changing throughout time. I mean, you're talking about meteorites that have, an orbital period of how long before they hit the Earth. You know, you got to take all that into context. You know, some of the meteorites that have been found in Antarctica and other places in the deserts of Earth, you know, come back with different ages. And we're talking, you know, billions of years to maybe millions of years. So, you know, Mars has gone through many transitional phases. So would you expect life on Earth to be compatible with life on Mars at this stage? We don't know. That's why it's important that we have to test it out. And one of the things that I heard recently is that the Lunar Gateway is still being considered.
There's conflicting data on that. Who knows? Because there's a new thing on Space Policy Online where they're saying the gateway's not needed to go to Mars, to go to the moon, and who knows what they're going to do with the gateway. So, and then the next day they're talking about selecting science experiments for it. So I don't know. Maybe John has a better idea of what's real and not real with the gateway, but I think a lot of it's up in the air. I mean, unknown.
It may be delayed, and, you know, it's not on critical path for going to the moon, but it's going to be hard to kill.
Well, it may not, so. But is it going to be used for anything? I mean, what is your take on it? Is it really going to be there?
I have no idea.
I have this article published March 13th. Okay, and NASA selects first science instrument
to
Lunar Gateway.
But they announced a policy the day before saying that it was no longer necessary for the Gateway to go to the lunar surface. So then why have the Gateway if you're not going to use it? So who knows? I'm just saying it seems to me it's in flux.
For deep space research and such and in preparing to go to Mars, but
I don't know. I think it's in flux, and I think the budgets for it are up in flux, and whether any of this, happens, I know the space cadets all think it's happening. I'm on the skeptical side, as is our friend Dr. Ben Arroyo. So I don't know. Maybe it's worth a show, but I don't know how we could get to the truth of this policy. I really don't.
It sounds like a good idea to have a module where you can examine Martians, not just Martians soil samples, but how about samples from Enceladus? You know, samples that we think could contain biology. We need to know how, it would react with the Earth's biosphere. And
Barry, let me ask you, and John can be on the phone, because a sizable part of this audience does not think that planetary protection is particularly useful, and it is. Well, you can laugh, but just a minute. They're taxpayers and paying their taxes for this crap the same way you are, and they don't deserve to be laughed at. And many of them are real, honest to God, hard hitting PhD scientists, which you are not. So let's not laugh at anybody because they have a different damn idea. But they say kind of what Zubrin says and other things, but they also think it's a policy to not really get humans on Mars, because there is a group of people at NASA that want to preserve Mars for scientific study, and they don't want all the humans going there. So there are lots and lots of contradictions there. So my question to you is, in your opinion, is what's happening with COVID-19 right now on Earth, where it doesn't appear any government can handle anything? Maybe South Korea does something better than us. I'm not sure about that. But look at the partners of ESA, and we're not an example as far as I'm concerned. The Bay Area, at least my part of the Bay Area, is absolutely in panic. I don't know if where John lives in the East Bay is as bad off as we are emotionally and psychology, but it is really scaring the crap out of people. So is this going to be like a high water mark that really changes human space flight and all this idea about space settlement, and we're going to go to Mars and Musk is going to go there with, hundreds of people and put them in that kind of an environment? Do you think we're looking at something that could really alter even our space programming? And John, I'd like you to comment on that too. It seems to me this might be powerful enough to, within a year or two, really have some kind of an impact we don't expect on human spaceflight.
My idea is that you have to do some work. You have to do some work to eliminate the possibility that life from Mars would do harm to the Earth, to the biosphere, not just humans, but whatever else effect it might have on the biosphere. So I think it's the responsibility of the spacefaring nations who want to bring it back to study that the first thing they have to do is study in an environment where you're guaranteed 100% that it won't harm the Earth. And once you have your study done in a significant laboratory where these experiments can be conducted, like in the Lunar Gateway, seems like a perfect idea. I mean, any astronauts or PhD scientists, microbiologists that are willing to go do this work, would also have to be willing to sacrifice their lives if something, you know.
What about humans going there and coming back?
Well, considering that we can all carry 10 trillion microorganisms each in our bodies, from astrobiologists that I've talked to, they said that could be the worst thing for Mars, like he just mentioned a little while ago, utterly contaminate the surface of Mars, which could happen in as little as 100 years, the whole planet.
John, you have comments on this?
Well, I understand both sides of the coin, so I would land in the middle somewhere. I think we should probably do a soil sample return and do some testing.
Where?
You know, not on Earth. So I agree with you. It should be, it should be, you know, in space.
I have a comment from Beverly in Seattle, and
sure.
She says, "What makes any of you think a lab on the Gateway or anything else would be 100% safe with humans and governments involved?"
Yeah, well, now you're talking a different type of science.
Well, it's not a bad question.
No, it's not. And in fact, you know, we're looking at this coronavirus situation, and you know, there's some talk about it being
man-made, right?
It kind of that same thing. I mean, that's a legit question. I mean, if they want to bring it back, they're going to bring it back, right?
Well, or they bring it back accidentally.
Yeah.
Because, you know, nobody's perfect. I mean, you said 100% safety, that, you know, you're not going to get 100% confidence interval.
I'm not sure about that. It depends on the time that you spend. You know, you would have to expose Martian soil and rock samples with any type of biology in it to, you know, things that exist here on the Earth. Of course, if the examination team survives, that's a good thing. You know, however, if, you know, there's an affinity for phytoplankton or something like that in the ocean, and if you remember what happened with the Apollo 11 capsule, you know, we were supposed to follow protocol and lift the capsule out of the sea before the door was opened on the capsule, and everybody was so excited about our astronauts returning, we just open that door, and all that dust on those spacesuits just went right into the ocean. So, I don't know.
You guys have an email, Dr. Doug,
okay,
in Southern California. He is, by the way, a medical doctor. But to be clear, the recent statement about the Gateway being unnecessary is only in respect to the 2024 mission. They haven't yet taken it off the critical path to sustainable base later in the decade. And while Doug is correct, I just have the sneaky feeling that the economics of all of this are going to be torn apart by what's going on, and nothing that we think of today is what's going to unfold in a year or two. I mean, that's just my hunch. I think the business community, the investment community, everything is going to change, and budgets are going to change. So one can plan ahead. I guess that's a good idea, but be flexible. I think things are really going to be different.
Barry, I have one more question, then I'll clear the line.
Sure.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, SpaceX is going to Mars. They want to go to Mars, and they're going to need a launch license, and so they have to be cleared by Planetary Protection. Do you think they'll be cleared for a launch license?
I think it's going to be hard in light of what's going on today. So many people are asking me that question because, you know, I'm also the person that runs the International Committee Against Mars Sample Return, and I don't mean it to be against Mars Sample Return. I'm favorable to that because we have to examine it, but it's where we examine it that's the big issue. You can't do it in a Earth-orbiting laboratory because if everybody dies on the Earth-orbiting laboratory, right, it will.
Yeah.
I mean, what happened to Skylab? Some chunks of it came down in Australia. You know, the space shuttle breakup, they found even some of the biology experiments that they had.
The ants survived.
Yes. So, you know, And I remember reading Buzz Aldrin's book, which was the most ironic tale of all. You know, he made a comment on the quarantine trailer that the him and Neil had to, and Mike had, and he said he could see ants going in and out of the trailer. He says,
I know.
So how much caution had been taken? I mean, if you talk to microbiologists about this, you know, they're like Carl Woese. You know, he's, you know, the guy that discovered the third domain of life on Earth.
Is he still around?
No.
Okay.
He died,
okay.
Unfortunately. But, you know, he stuck his neck out there making these comments, and I wanted to close out my book with his comments in it. But the book, you know, is much bigger than that. You know, the idea that life on Mars got to the metazoan level before Earth, you know, is pretty significant, I would think. And like John said, you know, how do we know that Mars wasn't the planet where Earth life came from? It's very possible.
John, do you anything else?
No, I don't. I'll clear the line. Thanks very much, Barry.
John, have a good day.
Thank you. Listeners, there is still time if you would like to join in our conversation via telephone or email for that matter. The telephone is 1-866-687-7223. Email drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And the phone line is currently available if you would like to give us a call. Barry, do you... I know your book is not necessarily focused on planetary protection, but that might be sort of a focus today. Have you ever tried to assess the likely, this is going to be funny, probability of some kind of specimen being examined on Mars that could be harmful here on Earth? Is there any kind of probability number that one could hang their hat on?
Well, I like to go back to Gil Levin's data from Viking, that he found something in the soil that looked very much like life.
Right.
Okay, and I go into great detail in my previous book, Mars, the Living Planet, about it. And I think that Gil Levin's data stand as the only warning sign that we need to do something more than wait over 40 years to send another set of biology instruments to the surface of Mars. I think we need to do that. And he's had a number of great ideas to look at the organism that might be in the soil, and they've all been rejected. So it clearly is apparent to me that NASA is avoiding the issue of life on Mars to a great extent, likely to, you know, keep the program rolling down the hill. And I understand that, you know, job security and all that, and making people wait. But this is a question that has been on people's minds since Viking. They want the answer to it now.
What would it take to get some analysis, and could it be done quickly? Is there anything on Earth already sealed up that could be used to give us that analysis?
There's all kinds of ideas out there, you know, for examining the surface material of Mars. You know, and Gil, I mean, look at him. He's 97 years old now.
Yeah, I mean, amazing.
He's been waiting a little bit for an answer, and still no microscope has been. A microscope would go a long way. Now, they put a geological microscope of limited resolution on Curiosity, but why not one that can resolve, you know, bacteria? That's an interesting question right there. Why not? I mean, if you could see things moving around, I mean, that would be some fairly convincing proof.
Jerry is in Houston, and he says, are you picking up any chatter outside of what you're talking about today of people comparing coronavirus to planetary protection and calling for strict standards? Is there anything brewing along those lines, given what's happening?
Well,
I don't know if you read space.com or the Leonard David Inside Space column.
Yeah, all
you
the
write.
Time. Uh-huh.
I have a lot of respect for Leonard as a writer, and he, you know, had an article about that very subject, and he wanted me to get some comments going, and I gave him comments. John Rummel, former Planetary Protection Officer, made some comments, and even got a couple quotes from Carl Sagan's books, and put together an interesting article about coronavirus and its effect on the Mars sample return community. So anybody wants to read that, I'm sure you could find it at the Leonard David Inside Space.
I'll link to that in the summary of the show.
Yeah, okay.
And we'll have that. Why is it important for us to know if these are trace fossils or not?
Okay, well, the first thing that I discussed with John is that if these are trace fossils and the Gale crater has been dated to that point, what it means is that Mars had, you know, a multicellular life 3 billion years before the Earth. So that says a lot right there.
Okay, so let me stop you. If they were confirmed as trace fossils, could there be another conclusion rather than the one you just said about multicellular life?
I'm not sure what you mean by that.
Okay, so you confirmed trace fossils on Mars. The conclusion is Mars had multicellular life before Earth.
It's a hypothesis. So.
That's a hypothesis. I'm asking you if there could be another hypothesis other than, okay, yes, there's trace fossils there. What does that mean? Could there be something else that it might mean other than Mars had multicellular life before Earth?
Well, I think that the, you know, the potassium-argon dating that Curiosity did on the surface there would basically limit the parameters of life, because we know that by about 3.5 or 3 billion years ago that, you know, the atmosphere was already at a rarefied state. The oceans were pretty much gone. And, you know, the Tharsis Bulge, you know, has been on the minds of scientists for a really long time. And you can see that on one side of the planet, something must have slammed into it, because Mars isn't a perfect sphere, and pushed up the area of the Tharsis Bulge, where all the volcanoes are. So it suffered a great impact, along with losing its iron core to put out a magnetic field to protect it, protect the surface from the radiation environment of the sun. And you also have the element of cosmic rays making it down to the surface level as well. So I think that, you know, Mars started off as a planet, the first blue marble, in fact, probably, and it got hit by a really large impact, and it just goes to show you what asteroid impacts can do on other planets, aside from the extinction event that occurred with the dinosaurs, and even before that in the Permian.
Where do you go next with your hypothesis? Is there any way you can advance it? Or do you need something from NASA, for example, to advance it?
Well, all they have to do is start finding other evidences of these objects. And I've been following the progress of Curiosity as it's making its way up Mount Sharp. And certainly recently there have been many, many intriguing features that are inexplicable at this point, and, you know, maybe some would say that they look like the type of features that you would find in corals or even other trace fossils. Part of the story of my book is that when I initially made the hypothesis, I was approached by two
a well-known invertebrate ichnologists who wrote a recent paper. You know, we were going to work together. They called me, and they said, "Hey, you know, we read about your hypothesis, and we think that it could be correct. But what would you think about writing a scientific paper with us?" They were one was from Italy, and the other one was from Portugal, and they just recently put out a scientific paper called "Ichnofossils, Cracks, or Crystals: A Test for the Biogenicity of Stick-like Structures from Vera Rubin Ridge on Mars." And they wrote this paper because I decided I wasn't going to write a paper with them because they wanted to spend too much time analyzing the crystals and salt idea that NASA put forth about these features. And I thought to myself, well, you know, the fact that these are metal sort of eliminates the possibility that they're salts or crystals. And I really didn't want to get tied up in a year defending NASA's, to me, ridiculous theory that these things were evidence of salt in an evaporating lake or crystals. So, you know, you don't get cylindrical crystals like that, and you don't have the same width. You don't have multiple cylindrical features. I mean, there's got to be at least 20, 25 cylindrical features meandering in and out of the host rock. Okay, how do you explain that as crystals or salts?
I don't know. You got another caller. You ready?
Okay, sure.
Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you, please?
Yeah, this is Tim from Huntsville.
Okay.
Hello, Tim.
Yeah, okay. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but if there was an actual risk of I guess, not just contamination, but infection from a Martian microbe, it wouldn't be a virus going in and hijacking, I guess, your genes to make more viruses, because it has to be specialized for their particular, particular prey. But it'd be more akin to a bacteria finding a nice, warm, dark place to reproduce in. Is that correct?
No, that's not according to Carl Wushi, who discovered the third domain of life on Earth. Microbiologist, you know, like he said, even if the NASA assumptions are reasonable, their argument does not rule out arguments based on different reasonable assumptions. When the entire biosphere hangs in the balance, it is adventurous to the extreme to bring Martian life here. Sure, there is a chance it would do no harm, but that is not the point. Unless you can rule out the chance that it might do harm, you should not embark on such a course. And I think that is just, you know, good reasoning, you know, in the realm of microbiology.
Well, this virus sure hasn't wasted any time to spread around fast.
No, and the fact that Mars might have had life reach the multicellular level really gets you interested in the ideas of viruses, because
Well, the thing is, though, if you look at, you know, nature right here, you don't have people worrying about catching Dutch elm disease or anything like this. And these are viruses that's been on, that has a lineage that goes back billions of years. But somehow the virus that just dropped in from Mars, assuming that there was no cross contamination from the get go with all the Martian material landing on Earth after it's been ejected from the surface from a large impact, hasn't already contaminated in the first place.
Yeah, well, you know, you can make that argument, but you know, you have to make sure that, who's going to write up the environmental impact statement that before you can bring any type of biology back to this planet? And they're going to have to mention it in the environmental impact, that there is a possibility, because Gilbert Levin, his data, no matter, you know, whether you're convinced by it or not, has to be used as a measuring stick. Something was found there that mimics biology, okay? And it does so under a host of different environmental conditions that he was able to concoct in his experiment that was on Mars. It was conducted 9 experiments, okay, at 2 different landing sites under different heating regimes and things like that. So you got to make sure. I mean, you got one biosphere. You know, how do you feel about it? Is it worth taking that kind of chance? And I often quote Carl Sagan here, who with his colleagues Joshua Lederberg and Elliot Leventhal, they published a famous article called Contamination of Mars in a 1968 issue of the journal Science. And this one quote, if this doesn't, you know, send a sort of shiver down your spine, I don't know what does. But here they are. They said, one terrestrial microorganism reproducing as slow as once a month on Mars without other ecological limitations in less than a decade would result in a microbial population of the Martian soil comparable to the Earth. Okay, if that calculation is true, then you're talking about something that would be an incredible...
I'm sure that would be a valid number if Mars had... if the Mars had organic material for the bacteria to feed on in the first place. But, you know, even putting aside the perchlorate chemistry in the soil itself that's supposed to sterilize what a lot of people thought for a while would have sterilized the entire surface. Putting that aside, there's nothing there for the microbes to really eat anyway.
Well, they found the organic molecules.
So, I mean, the microbes still have to obey the conservation of mass. So they would have to have a certain amount of organic material to consume. If they don't, you know, those calculations are meaningless.
Well,
as putting in a negative value if you try and do a ballistic trajectory, because if you actually do the calculation for a ballistic trajectory, you can sometimes get a negative value in there. People just put that to the side because it's nonsensical to plug that in for that.
You make a good point, but, you know, what do you think of the Curiosity data that show that not only were kerogens found on Mars, but long-chain fatty acids, organic molecules in the rocks, soil, and methane in the atmosphere. I mean, you're talking about what kind of source would microorganisms have for food. It depends on the type of microorganism that it is. But it sounds like those things that I just mentioned there would be, you know, fairly consumable by microorganisms.
In what amount, though? That's the thing. I don't, you know, are you talking about minute quantities? Because, yeah, my equipment found this certain element right here. Well, how sensitive is the equipment? Are you finding parts per million, maybe even parts per billion? I'd have to know.
Yeah, well, that's why we need more testing. And why not send a few more actual life sciences experiments to Mars to find out for sure? I mean, there are brilliant ways of accomplishing this today with new technologies. And, you know, so far it's not been permitted on any lander or rover since Viking.
Tim, I'm assuming you would say sample return and go to Mars and don't worry about planetary protection. Am I correct?
Pretty much. I mean, if we were going to be this cautious, we would have never would have activated the super collider. We'd be afraid of creating some sort of black hole and eat up the entire Earth or something to that effect.
They still are. Nobody knows what's going to happen. I mean, we may in fact do something like that. There's a lot of talk about black holes. You know,
well,
drifting through space.
Well, if that was a danger, it would have happened a long time ago. Because if I recall correctly, the OMG particle had what 10 to the 20th electron volts of energy, of kinetic energy. It was one subatomic particle that had the kinetic energy of like a baseball of a softball going like 90 miles an hour, something to that effect. I don't know the exact number, but somewhere around there. And that is far, far above anything you would see with that super collider. I think it's in the tera electron volt range for the superconducting super collider.
Right.
Well, if nature is constantly throwing these particles with far greater energy at Earth than what can be produced by artificial means, then it seems kind of odd to be afraid of it.
Well, do you think that the idea is to send a spacecraft full of people to Mars to find out if it's pathogenic there, and then if they die, not to do it again? Or do you think we should bear on the side of caution and examine it on the surface there to see what we can glean from that?
I know for the long duration Mars missions, or at least for some of them, they're talking about like being on Mars for 500 days. That far exceeds any quarantine that I know of.
Yeah, but you're talking about 10 billion microorganisms per human being contaminating the surface of Mars. Well, how do you feel about that? You know, the fact that they're on the surface contaminating it and eliminating the possibility of finding out maybe the clues to the origin of life. I mean, it's a big question, you know. I prefer that science progress in stages and that we don't send like 60 people to Mars just to find out that it's deadly. I mean, there's other reasons, too. You know, just the journey to Mars, a six-month journey to Mars in the cosmic radiation, you don't even know how your own body's microorganisms are going to react. Because as I talked about earlier with Cheryl Nickerson's research on the International Space Station and Space Shuttle, they see a remarkable increase in virulence just going up into Earth orbit. So, you know, once you leave the Earth's magnetic field, you're on your way to Mars, and you're being exposed to the radiation events coming in from the galaxy itself. But you might reach Mars, and I don't know, and you may not be able to come back just because of that.
I'm sure you, there's enough people out there that would want to be the first people on Mars. They will take those risks and then some. So,
but
I'm not really all that concerned.
Yeah, sure, they're willing to take the risks, but who are they willing to take the risk for? You, me, you know, for all mankind, sort of situation, or should we just, you know, why not send some additional life detection experiments to Mars now? In preparation of that,
I can tell you they would probably take the risk for themselves because they want to be the first people there. That's who they're taking the risk for. You know, there's lots of people. I would like to be one of the first people there. I know the odds of me there are practically zero, but I would love to be one on there. I would take the risk.
Yeah,
well, but you might get a Darwin Award, Tim.
Well, people got a Darwin Award for less. So,
absolutely.
Well, it looks like yes.
Anything else, Tim? Anything else you want to comment on?
If you're too cautious about anything, you won't accomplish anything at all. I just want to point that out. If you act too cautious, nothing will get done.
Okay, so you're saying don't wash your hands.
I wash my hands, yeah. I'm talking about within reason. All right, let's go like this. I have to leave the house and work, right? But there's always a chance of me getting killed in a car wreck. Well, I could stay inside. Try to find a way to stay inside my house and be a prisoner for the rest of my life to minimize my risk. Or I can just, put on my seatbelt and pay attention to the road and drive from point A to point B and not worry about it.
And I think with microorganisms, though, you're talking about a whole different ballgame. Well, they're mighty unforgiving if they're the wrong type of organism, if they're pathogenic. So until we're really sure, I just think that I would, like, if you wanted to be the first to step on the surface, I'm all for it. You know, I'm all for it because, you know, the testing would be done before you went in, from my perspective. And I could say, I knew Tim, you know. We did the, we knew the situation with the microbes. We determined that there was no pathogens there, and we can safely go to Mars. But right now, as it stands, there's the evidence from the Viking spacecraft that shows that there's something there, and whatever it is, it should be examined. It shouldn't be put in a closet for 40 years. Okay, NASA at this stage of the game with the kerogens, fatty acids, and organic molecules they found in Gale Crater, they could come out right now and say, yeah, we're looking back at the Viking lander biology experiments, and we now think that, you know, that they, that the biology experiment discovered something important. They could at least do that, but no, they're proceeding like that data doesn't exist. And that's one thing that science really doesn't do, is they never get rid of good data. And that's what bothers me the most, is that they keep pushing that data out of the way in spite of the new discoveries that they've made. So anyways,
Tim, anything else? I want to move on.
No, that's it.
Okay. Thank you.
Tim, good talk to you.
Barry, we're past the 90 minutes or so, but is there something more that we've forgotten or omitted that you wanted to bring to our attention, or do you have a unique way of concluding for us? What would you like us to hold on to other than don't bring it back to Earth?
Well, actually, what I would like is I would like people to first have a look at my book, my theory in the book, the numerous images. I mean, there's at least 200 images in there, and come to your own conclusion. You know, are those biological or are those salts and crystals from an evaporating lake? And then, of course, I would encourage you to follow the Mars Science Laboratory images that are returned every day to Earth, and you can just study those images and see, you know, what other familiar features, if there are others like that, as we go up the side of the mountain. And, of course, as we're moving up the side of the mountain, we're entering younger and younger periods that existed. And so, you know, we're literally going into the future. We found a lake in a 3.7 billion-year-old crater. And we're climbing the mountain, and when we get to maybe the midway point, we're going to find why life died out on Mars.
You have another email, 11th hour email from John in Fort Worth.
Okay.
What if Mars microbes would find our environment toxic? Isn't that just as likely?
Well, sure, but you have to go through the science to make sure. I mean, because the opposite might be true. Like, for example, what if Martian microbes only liked phytoplankton in the sea, diatoms, you know?
Uh-huh.
The things that make the 80% of the oxygen on Earth. That could be detrimental. So it all comes back to, you know, good science, microbiology. You know, when you're dealing with biology from other worlds, I think we're entering a new era of space explanation. We need to make sure we don't just jump the gun. You know, it's like leaving in a solar storm. You know, you're on your way to Mars, solar storm comes up, and if you don't have the equivalent shielding to protect you, you might be roasted, you know, before you get there. So everything needs to be considered. You can't just haphazardly go out and explore space. It's a new landscape, and we got to make sure that we don't, number one, send anybody to Mars that would be instantly killed, because they'll be staying there for a while. And another thing is, any sort of ill astronaut, if you bring them back with a pathogen, you may not want to deal with it if it gets loose on our planet. So I'm all about, good science. Let's make sure it's safe to send people, and then let's go. Let's build enclosures and start a society on Mars, real Mars society.
How do people get your book?
You go to Amazon.com. You look up my name, or you can just look up Barry DiGregorio, and it will take you right there. And the book is actually an e-book, okay? I decided to make it an e-book because today most people read books on their devices and things like that. So I thought that would be easier and more efficient.
Okay, and they download it off of Amazon. And
yeah.
What about an e-book on Barnes & Noble or other formats? Is it available in those formats too?
Not yet. I'm making my own website at this point, and I will make it available as a PDF from that when it's available. But right now, it's available almost in all countries on Amazon.com.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to offer us for today?
Yeah, folks, listen to your county officials. Make sure you wash your hands and, whatever they're doing to keep people at a distance from each other, to keep us all safe and protect our children from getting ill. I think we should follow any good advice they have.
Yeah, and protect our geezers, too.
Yeah, well, the geezers, I don't feel so sorry for, because I'm one myself, see?
Yeah, well, I am one, too.
I'm going to be 67 this
year. Oh, you're so. Just a spring chicken.
A youngin', yeah.
Yeah.
They said anybody over 60.
That's right. So you qualify, but I'm almost 74. So got to protect us, too, everybody.
That's right.
Barry, thank you very much. I'm sure we'll talk to you a lot more about this topic as well. And hopefully Gil, too. Wow, 97, and he was just on the show, a month ago with you. And, it's amazing how great he's doing.
Resilient.
I hope he's washing his hands and staying inside.
I'm sure he is.
He is really, really resilient, especially to take all this crap from NASA over the years. It's probably made him a stronger person, Barry.
Yeah, Nietzsche, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Listeners, that's it for today. We certainly thank Barry for being with us, all of your phone calls, your email. Remember, it's a full week on the Space Show, Tuesday, Hotel Mars Wednesday, Friday, open lines on Sunday. Keep looking up. Remember Jeff Bell when you get a chance. We'll miss him on the Space Show. And as Barry said, keep safe, wash your hands, do what you have to do, and have a great weekend. Don't go shopping. That might not be so much fun. Barry says thank you. I say thank you. And again, keep looking up. Goodbye from the Space Show.